you are.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. As the U.S. military begins its fourth week of bombing in Afghanistan, the ruling Taliban continues to show no signs of giving up the fight. But part of winning will clearly be in imagining the government that could rise from the ashes of a Taliban demise. Tonight, we're looking for the roots of a new Afghan nation. First, more fallout and questions after the capture and execution by the Taliban of prominent opposition leader Abdul Haq. Earlier today, I spoke with Wall Street Journal correspondent Steve Levine in Pakistan. I asked him how Abdul Haq went from warrior against the Soviets to enemy of the Taliban.
He was part of the Mujahideen force. He ran an underground group of guys who fought in the city of Kabul, actually, setting off car bombs and stuff like that, and gained some fame, got his foot blown off by a mine, and then sat out the rest of the war in Peshawar. He got fed up at the end of the war when the Mujahideen began infighting and moved to Dubai and became a businessman. He got on the wrong side of Pakistan because he began opposing the Taliban when they took power in 96. They banned him from returning to Pakistan, but he began his own efforts to try to get other exiled Afghans organized in a way that they could replace the Taliban. And along the way, he met up with this wealthy American former commodities trader, James Ritchie. And this fellow is a guy who spent his early childhood in Afghanistan and retains a romantic view of it. And he started bankrolling Haq's activities.
So what was Haq doing in Afghanistan last week? How did he get there? What was his agenda?
What he wanted to do was to incite a rebellion against the Taliban. He's a Pashtun, which is the majority ethnic group in Afghanistan. And what he wanted to do was to collect, organize as many other Pashtun leaders as he could to defect against the Taliban. Ritchie had either totally or partly bankrolled his trip in.
They asked the CIA for support that they didn't get.
Yeah, this is a mystifying thing that for some months preceding the September 11th events, the CIA has been in Pakistan attempting to organize Pashtun commanders against the Taliban. And what I've got is that they somehow have selected a bunch of these commanders to receive money and satellite telephones. What I was told, however, is that either few or none of these commanders did anything, and that many of them simply left with the money and the phones, and they were never heard from again.
Haq tried to do something with it, but he wanted more than a satellite phone and some cash.
What I'm told, Tom, is that he has a long history with the CIA of not being trusted, of being seen as a publicity seeker. He desperately wanted assistance from the U.S. and, in fact, had long contacts with the political side, the State Department. I'm not certain exactly what he wanted, but it looks like what he wanted was a drop of a radio transmitter inside Afghanistan, some access to weapons, and maybe some transportation.
In the event the Taliban discovered him and were in hot pursuit, the U.S. did attempt to give him some air cover as he tried to escape.
Well, it was a little bit too little too late. He was trapped on his way out. He's part of a 19-man group. He's on a horse. He's a very heavy guy with only one foot. And, you know, the Taliban started shooting. They had a sat phone with them. They called to their house in Peshawar. Whoever answered the phone got James Ritchie on the phone. Ritchie calls Bud McFarlane, Reagan's national security advisor, who's a paid advisor to Abdul Haq. And McFarlane calls his former contacts in the agency and I guess in the military and persuaded them to get on the phone with Haq and with Ritchie. Ritchie says that he was on the phone for the next 4 hours, every 10 or 15 minutes, back and forth with Washington and with Haq's guys, and that he tried to get them to send in a helicopter to pick them up. It was seen as too risky. They offered to bomb, and what happened was after 4 hours, the Taliban caught him, and a half hour after that, the U.S. dropped a bomb uselessly on a convoy that was, you know, a few miles away from the incident.
And Abdul-Haq was soon executed.
He was executed 11 hours later.
Steve, what problems does this illustrate for the CIA as it attempts to play a role in Afghanistan right now?
The biggest problem is that the U.S. again looks like an unreliable partner. There have been no major Pashtun defections. Mm-hmm. If anyone was sitting on a fence and thinking of defecting, they know now that they're not going to be backed up by the U.S., and they also know that if they're caught, they're going to be killed. This creates a huge problem for the CIA.
Is it mainly a problem in terms of ousting the Taliban or in terms of setting up a new government after the Taliban's gone, or both?
Once the Taliban's gone, you know, the Afghans will go with the winner. This is the tradition there, is creating an image of force, an image of strength, so that you appear to have the advantage, and then you're in a bargaining position to then create defections to your side. So as soon as you're seen as a loser or as not a clear winner, which is the way the U.S. looks now, you have trouble.
Steve Levine is Central Asia correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. I spoke to him earlier today from Peshawar, Pakistan. As difficult as a U.S. victory in Afghanistan might be, it looks almost impossible unless we can imagine and get others to believe in what comes next. Tonight, we're talking about a post-Taliban political and social landscape in Afghanistan. What might it look like? Who should be part of the government? I'm joined in the studio now by Thomas Simons. He was ambassador to Pakistan from 1996 to 1998 and now teaches at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. Good evening, Professor and Ambassador Thomas Simons.
It's great to be here.
Good to have you. Thanks for coming in. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Ambassador Thomas Simons, you were in Pakistan from 96 to 98. You've seen Afghanistan up close. You heard with the rest of us the report we just got from Steve Levine in Peshawar, looking across the border at the sad story of Abdul-Haq, killed at the end of last week when he was inside Afghanistan trying to pull together Pashtun resistance to the Taliban. It sounds like a mess. How does the United States find its footing on this issue of a post-Taliban government?
Well, I think by being patient and careful. I think mm-hmm. Steve's analysis was really very sound. Abdul-Haq's death is a setback. He's right that Afghans tend to go with the winner. We're trying to create an impression of strength and success, and obviously Taliban has terrific intel and has gone out and gotten someone who is trying to provoke the sorts of defections that are going to be required to put together a post-Taliban government. So it's a setback. At the same time, I have to point out what a bizarre episode it was and what a small-scale episode it was. And I think listeners ought to get used to a phase of the war that we're now entering where things are sort of murky and bizarre and hard to figure out. It's sort of the long twilight struggle that President Kennedy talked about. We've been through the outrage, the mobilization, the creating support, and now we're in for the long haul. And in Afghanistan, we're dealing with people who are there are no angels in Afghanistan. There are heroes and villains, and often people are both together. Mm-hmm. And Abdul-Haq, I think, shared a little bit of that. If you look at the commentaries on Abdul-Haq, you know, they range from heroization to demonization, I mean, to horrible slander that he was Hollywood Huck, to this is the man who's the key to the post-Taliban government. And the truth is probably somewhere in between and very hard to figure out.
And yet, what an ending, kind of a sad Hollywood ending, on horseback, trying to flee the country, a U.S. armed U.S. drone coming in a half hour late to bomb the Taliban behind him, him hanged, his brother executed, a bunch of others in the party, fate unknown. And as you say, it's only one incident. You know, it seemed a couple of weeks ago, we've been getting this alternating current of messages from Washington. It's not just Americans' imagination that there was some expectation that this might happen quickly. It might all be over fairly quickly. Of course, the other message has always been there, too. Now it seems that we almost can't win the struggle that we're in without imagining and communicating what a post-Taliban government will look like. Can we win without figuring this out or at least setting up some framework for it?
Well, I think we're starting to do that. I think when Secretary Powell was in Islamabad, he and President Musharraf got together and they sort of ticked off the elements mm-hmm. that are probably going to have to be part of a post-Taliban regime. It includes elements from the Northern Alliance. It includes elements from the party of former King Zahir Shah mm-hmm. In Rome. It includes moderate elements from Taliban. I mean, that's contested now as to whether such a thing exists. I think it probably does. Tribal elders and outside Afghans, because most of the educated people in the country are now outside the country, and some of them are going to need to come back to help run the country. But those five elements are the components, and they really, another element, it ought to represent all the major ethnic groups, the Pashtuns, who are a plurality or half the population, the Tajiks, Persian-speaking people in the north, Uzbeks, Turkic-speaking people also in the north, and the Hazaras, who are Shia, the not the mainstream, but the minority sector in the Central Mountains. All those people need to be in on it, and I think we're thinking in that direction.
We hear that the United States has held back militarily around Kabul, perhaps, to buy time for a political groundwork for this to be laid. Is it happening? Do you see progress?
Well, I think, once again, I think you see progress in the sense. I mean, let me give you an example. You had a meeting in Peshawar a couple of days ago of Pashtun tribal people from both sides of the frontier. It was not a meeting that the United States thought was wise. It was something put on by the Pakistanis. Mm-hmm. The people who came together, I don't think you should exaggerate the success of it, but they did come together on a program which said that there's a role for the king and Afghanistan ought to get rid of foreigners who are causing trouble for the country. Now, they didn't name Osama bin Laden, but that's fairly clear for a group like that. Now, that's a step in the right direction. It's hard to tell in this murky situation what exactly negotiations are going on with which groups. I mean, but I wouldn't simply write it off as a failure because it hasn't worked so far.
Jack Beattie, what questions come to your mind as you look out on this post-Taliban world that we'd like to get to but doesn't seem all that accessible?
Well, I'm struck by a statement today from Mr. Lakhdar Brahami, who's the special representative of the UN. He's in Pakistan, but he sent his special representative on Afghanistan. He said, if a way can be found to liberate and empower the people of Afghanistan, this is something the international community can eventually be proud of. I thought, well, that's really quite a statement, something the internet. I'm just curious, Mr. Ambassador, what could the international community do for which it would be proud in Afghanistan? Give us the outlines of the possible here.
Well, it can help Afghans put in place a structure in which they could all feel at home, which they all own, as the American political phrase goes, which assures them that most of them will stay alive, which gives them disincentives for breaking it up and incentives to keep it going.
We're talking this hour about a post-Taliban government and society in Afghanistan. A couple of weeks ago, it seemed like it might be around the corner somehow. Now it looks like it may be further away, but can we possibly win a war without it? We'd like to hear from you. Can the United States successfully engineer a future for Afghanistan? Do we have a choice? And once something's established, does the United Nations have the capacity to implement and perhaps oversee, as President George Bush has suggested, a post-Taliban Afghanistan? How close does it seem? How far? What's your insight? Share it with us. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. You can go online and read Ambassador Thomas Simon's article, Roots of an Afghan Nation, at our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. Also, check out the forums there. There's a lot of great interaction between listeners who are listening closely and sharing their views online. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about a post-Taliban Afghanistan. No one's suggesting it'll be easy to get there, but it increasingly looks like it may be impossible to get there unless all the players involved can see, have some idea of what comes next. What is the proper U.S. role in engineering a future government for Afghanistan? Can we do it? Do we have a choice? And when it comes time to oversee that government, if oversight is necessary, does the UN have the capacity to do that, as President George Bush suggests and hopes? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined this evening by Thomas Simons, former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, 1996-98, currently teaches at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University, and, as always, by our own Jack Beatty. Ambassador Simons, we heard from the State Department today. They said that we have not come to this with a detailed blueprint, that is, for post-Taliban Afghanistan. This is a line we've heard again and again. They said it's up to the Afghans to figure it out. Please deconstruct that for us. We're all over this issue. We have major interests at stake here, but we keep saying it's up to them. What's going on here?
Well, I think it's the beginning of wisdom, because we don't have the power and authority to impose a solution on Afghanistan. So I think it's simply smart to say that. As you say, we're going to have a big role in it. But I think the question of the U.S. role and the U.N. role really go together. I think we're going to have our input. It has to be something that is acceptable to a minimum of Afghan elites, if I could put it that way, in their various regions from the various groups. We can help put that together. We can supply some of the incentives and disincentives. But since we are so much a player, and especially now that we're the point of the lance in terms of the military operations, and the opposition is going to try to paint us as the enemy and anti-Islamic. In other words, we represent an attack on Islam. Not true, but that will be the political dialogue. We are going to have to be in a position of supporting someone else, and that someone else really needs to be the United Nations. If for no other reason than that the United Nations is one place where – is one of the few places where the United States and Iran can work together under one umbrella. That has been true in Afghanistan from the beginning. It remains true now. All of Afghanistan's neighbors, Iran, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Pakistan, very importantly. Afghanistan has a tiny border with China. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to be involved. And behind there, over the horizon, Russia. They're all going to have to be involved. And the UN is going to be very important to keep the U.S. and Iran in that same stable.
What a stew. You've written, and Jack Beatty was alluding to this before the break, I think, but you've said that when we look at the post-Taliban Afghanistan, we should not assume that it must be an Islamic state, and we should not assume, despite the talk about all the different tribes, that it needs to be chopped up into tribal fiefdoms, that there may be a middle way. To Jack's question earlier, what is the shape, if that's an ideal that you're suggesting, what is the shape of something that's neither Islamic nor strictly tribal, and what's your basis for confidence that that can come to be?
Well, I'm not sure it's a basis for confidence. Confidence that it could come to be. In other words, that there are the makings of something like that out there and that they're too often lost sight of in most analysis. I think Afghanistan will be an Islamic country and possibly an Islamic state. But I make a radical distinction between Islamic and Islamist. In other words, the kind of radical Islamist salvationist regime that the Taliban has set as its goal, and an Islamic state like Pakistan, like many of the states in the Middle East. I mean, I would accept Saudi Arabia because it has a special ideological basis.
You point out that Afghanistan historically, traditionally, has not been so rigorously Islamic.
Well, that's right. But they're all good Muslims. Mm-hmm. And so the government has always respected Islamic mores, some of which are peculiar. I mean, the coverage of women in Afghanistan is probably historically one of the strictest in the Islamic world. But Islamic, but not Islamist. On the other hand, also not tribal. I mean, I think, and for two reasons. First, the old kind of comfortable coalition of ethnic groups under the king, I think, has been destroyed first by modernization and then by 22 years of war. the kind of tribalism that you get now is the kind of savage tribalism that Afghanistan, mind you, has not gone as far as Bosnia or Rwanda or Burundi. Mm-hmm. But that kind of tribalism as an excuse for bloodletting, which is one of the dangers in Afghanistan, that would be a new phenomenon in Afghanistan.
Not an old one.
And not a return to tradition. Meanwhile, I think what is underestimated is the feeling that Afghans have for their country, the richness of the—
As a whole.
I mean, they're from all ethnic groups. When you talk to Afghans, they've been through these 22 years of war. Their first primary identification is ethnic. But then you discover that they love the country and all dislike foreigners. They all want to defend its independence and territorial integrity against foreigners down the road.
And when you say foreigners, do they include Arabs, for example, in that group?
They include Arabs. They include Pakistanis. They included the Soviets.
All of whom have played a role in many of whom continue to.
And it includes the Americans.
Yes.
Which is why we ought to be, you know, fairly sensitive in the kind of advice that we give. But that there are real bases for a sense of national community. And I think it's an asset that can be built on and should be built on as we look out at this problem, this terrible problem. Very hard to be optimistic of putting together a stabilizing post-Taliban regime, but I think it's possible.
Jack Beatty, do you see a convincing outline of the future emerging there?
Well, it's that's beyond me. But there are some models in the past, albeit different with different histories. But for example, consider the Cambodian peacekeeping mission of the UN leading up to the 1993 elections, first free elections in Cambodia, where 90% of the people voted. 100 countries took part in this. They sent 15,000 troops, 3,000 police and civic workers, a $2 billion price tag. And what they tried to do was to reconstruct, rehabilitate, and bring back within Cambodia the refugees, some 350,000, who were outside. And they were doing this under circumstances not entirely dissimilar to those in Afghanistan. A war was still going on. There was someone like the Taliban on the scene, the Khmer Rouge. And yet they succeeded. How? Well, according to one paper I read, by making it plain to people that they could have a stake in a new order while they were doing long-term work on terms of civic education and building large infrastructure and so on, they had a number of what they call quick impact projects, things that could allow ordinary people to see progress right there. They rebuilt, that they gave them the material to make wells, to dig latrines, to repair bridges, they immunized children. All of this was labor intensive. It put people to work. They gave them seeds. They gave them farm implements. And basically, they had to sustain them for a year, the new refugees and the villages. But at the end of that time, because of the seed money, literally, they were able to feed themselves. And this was an extraordinary successful venture, admittedly in a different terrain. But it made me think that there is something in the background here, that the UN really did a remarkable job in reconstituting what was as war-torn and miserable a place as Afghanistan.
Ambassador Thomas Simons, you've looked across the border at Afghanistan from Pakistan and know it well. I don't know how familiar you are with the Cambodian scenario, but what about the UN background here and the Cambodian model?
I think that what Jack said seems to me very sensible. I mean, I would even bring in Bosnia. They said a couple of years ago people were very skeptical that Bosnia could hold together even as well as it has. I think it's taken more outside input. But Cambodia is an excellent example. And I'd like to underline one of the points that Jack made, which is in a situation of wholesale destruction and devastation, such as Cambodia faced, such as Afghanistan now faces, you can get very large returns on fairly modest inputs if you work the program right. I mean, people are anxious to get back to growing crops, setting up marketing networks, feeding themselves. And so I'm not sure you need something on the scale of the Marshall Plan, which was for half a continent, for a ruined country of 17 to 20 million. I think you can get very large advances in terms of economic recovery, reconstruction for decent, sustained, but also fairly modest inputs.
were looking for light in a tough situation, looking for what might come after the Taliban, looking in part because it now seems that the Taliban may stick around until someone can describe what the future will look like and describe it convincingly. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ron is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Ron. You're on the air.
Thank you. To the ambassador's point, the concern I have is there is no model that I see for them to aspire to. You've got the theocracy of Iran. You've got the dictatorship of Iraq. You don't really have a solid Muslim based, which I truly believe is what's going to have to be the root of the new government for them to model themselves after.
Let's put that to the ambassador, Ron, and hang on. What about it? Is there an Islamic model for them to follow here?
I don't think there's a perfect Islamic model, but they have the model of the old regime, which I think many Afghans are nostalgic for as a time of decent security and fairly modest well-being. And they can make that more Islamic. I mean, it can still be a coalition of ethnic groups under a central government, which espouses Islamic ideals and modest Islamic practice, but is mainly a Reconstructionist regime.
So you're looking back to before the Soviet invasion, back to the 70s and earlier, and saying Afghanistan has a model in its own history.
But I don't think you can replicate the monarchy. In other words, I think probably the monarchy is gone forever, although King Zahir Shah could play a role in bringing a post-Taliban situation together.
Ron, what we hear in your question is some skepticism about a more representative government in an Islamic nation today.
Well, I believe that's truly the issue here, because I don't think they know where they want to be. They don't know where they're going to go. They don't have a true direction. And I think, you know, culturally we can't provide that because we live in a totally different culture.
We take your point, Ron, and thanks for your call.
I think they're going to be backing forward. In other words, I think you need a combination of incentives and disincentives, things that allow them to buy in to a regime, and I think there's a tremendous hunger for peace in the country. I think you're going to need sustained assistance, sustained advice, and sustained threat of intervention for people who start breaking the new peace. And I think when you put that together, the Afghans will then work out something that may be new, for which there is no model, but which will be satisfactory to them.
We've got another caller on the line. In fact, several more. Let's see if we can get some in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about post-Taliban Afghanistan and what role the United States should play in helping shape it. Sai is on the line. Welcome, Sai.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The point that I'd like to raise is, and it seems to be escaping most of the programs, is the role of opium. Afghanistan is the number one exporter of opium and has been. And if a government is to be sustainable in Afghanistan, one has to address the question of opium.
Well, but then it's an interesting question, isn't it, whether they need the opium money to float or whether there can be a substitute for that. How about it, Ambassador Tom Simons?
Well, right now it's the only cash crop in the country. I mean, the degradation of agriculture has been so severe that it's the only thing that will make farmers money. Nevertheless, the Taliban itself, over the last 2 years, I think the motives are probably mixed because stocks are very high. On the basis of good verification, I think observation by UN offices has very substantially cut down on opium production. What is needed is to give farmers something to replace it, something they can live on without producing opium. The Pakistanis right next door have done that. I mean, have under my tenure and with our assistance and UN assistance have really almost eradicated opium poppy production. I think you can do that in Afghanistan.
We're talking about a post-Taliban Afghanistan. You can join at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty?
Well, you know, I was struck the other day with seeing an interview with a Pakistani official who said, the Afghan government, he says, that's kind of a verbal figment. He said the budget of the current Afghan government is $38 million. I dare say there are public radio stations whose budget is about that. Ambassador, When we say government here, we mean a very loose sort of structure, don't we? I mean, this is a very decentralized country.
Jack, I think we do, but I don't, and I think any government, I said it in my little piece in the Times, is going to have to be decentralized. The ethnic groups are going to have to enjoy very substantial autonomy in their home reasons, but regions. But I don't think you should run down the role of central government as an effective agent of economic reconstruction and also of national community, if I can put it that way. They've had it before. They deserve it again. Now, it is true that the Taliban has remained a religious and fighting movement, which has never developed most of the attributes of government. But that goes back to a previous point. I think you can get a lot of mileage out of fairly modest new national institutions. I think that's there's a margin out there for that, too.
And what about the problem raised by callers earlier, and you pointed out, that no one can be seen right now as siding with the anti-Islamic forces, and the United States has been tarred as anti-Islamic despite all of our protestations. How do we get around that? Can we embrace anyone without making them anathema?
Yeah, I think you can. I mean, I think you just have to keep working away at it. You have to keep telling them that we're not anti-Islamic. I think the kinds of assistance that go out there, I'm not sure it'll be better if you can give it directly and rather than drop it off of airplanes. But I think that there are things you can never get rid of the problem, but I think that you can win the center of Afghan opinion over time if you can help put together a government that works and in which Afghans have a stake.
We're talking about a post-Taliban Afghanistan, what it might look like. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. It won't be easy, but if the Taliban's ever to go away, there has to be something to come in and be there in its place. Can the U.S. successfully engineer a future for Afghanistan? Do we have a choice? We've just got a few seconds before the break, Ambassador, but we note that the U.N. envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, once before resigned in frustration over ever finding a solution to this knot, and that's before everything exploded.
Well, I'm a friend and was a colleague of Lakhdar Brahimi and his when he was coordinator. He resigned out of frustration because the Afghans at that point were in charge of totally in charge of their own destiny and were willing to fight forever for what they believed in. So there wasn't much role for a negotiator, and the outside powers had fairly modest interest. I mean, when I was ambassador to Pakistan for those 2.5 years, one of my jobs was to try to get my own government more interested in Afghanistan than they were, that was successful. Of course, I had neither the option nor the desire to quit, as he did. But I think all of us who cared about Afghanistan were in that situation. That's now been reversed. Now governments care a lot. The question is what to do.
It certainly got our attention now. We're talking about Afghanistan in a post-Taliban era. What role can the U.S. play? What role should the U.S. play in shaping the next government? What should it look like? How will it emerge? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about a post-Taliban world in Afghanistan, what it might look like. A couple of weeks ago, it seemed like it just might be a cakewalk. Now it looks like it surely, certainly won't be. But still, without imagining a post-Taliban world, who knows how we'll ever get there? What do you think? What should the U.S. role be? Can the United States successfully engineer a future for Afghanistan? Do we have a choice? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Lee is on the line. Welcome, Lee. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I don't share the calm assurance of your other speakers about this thing.
Okay.
I think since the United States is going to the greatest extent in its history to do something on this scale, we should insist on nothing less than a constitutional government over there with separation of church and state. And the feeling that was expressed by the speakers that, oh, that yes, we have to be Islamist. I think we ought to forget about Islam, Jewish, Christian, atheist, and the idea of going along after an effort of this scope to have women still in veils under this Islamist law is ridiculous. And I think the model should be Turkey, where they made more progress than any Middle East country due to Ataturks coming in there and definitely having a constitutional form of government with religion playing no role at all in the government.
Mm. Lee, we hear your skepticism and your fervor. You describe a situation almost like post-World War II, where we went in and remade Germany and Japan. Ambassador Thomas Simons, what about it? Should we settle for less than something really revolutionary there?
I don't think we have the option to go for something revolutionary. In other words, I think from my point of view, knowing I'm a great admirer of Turkey also, but I think that the Turkish government arose over 20 years in very special circumstances. I think to try to impose that, I don't think we have the power or the sustained support to impose that kind of thing on a country like Afghanistan. Now, that doesn't mean we should forget about those kinds of objectives. I think we should push, we should nurture, we should encourage. But to expect that, I think we'll cut against the main object. I think it'll make attaining our objectives harder rather than easier.
So it just may be out of reach. We have a lot of callers who want to join. Thank you for your call, Lee. Ayaz is on the line. Welcome, Ayaz.
Hi. Good evening.
Good evening.
Whenever we try to decide as Americans or as quote-unquote Western powers mm-hmm. what the government should be in another country, it's fundamentally a problem with me anyway. I mean, I as an American, I would find it highly offensive and really, you know, really pain me to the marrow of my bones if someone says, hey, this is how the American government should look like.
So it sounds like a new imperialism to you, Ayaz.
I don't think. I think certainly it will be perceived in that part of the world as neo-imperialism, colonialism, and so on and so forth. I mean, I think we have to, if I understand Afghanistan in terms of being a highly tribal society, the allegiance of the people is to that tribal lord. And for us to go in there, speaking of the wonderful tenets that we live our life every day, and thank God for that, I think we are speaking of, if anybody's seen the Matrix movie, it's Matrix A versus Matrix B. We haven't really asked the fundamental questions of settling the equilibrium. How do we bring Matrix A to Matrix B first?
Ayaz, you're breaking up a little bit, but I think we've got the gist of your call. And let me put it to Ambassador Thomas Simon. Here, you see these calls back to back. One that says, if we're going to spend all this blood and resources, then let's go in and build something in the Western model. The second call that says, where on earth do we have the presumption to think we have anything to do with it? Now, in fairness, Washington is saying we're not going to decide, and you're saying the same, yet how can we not play a role? It seems necessary to somehow bring order here that at least puts a clamp down on the terrorist activity that's originated in Afghanistan.
Well, I spent 35 years in the State Department, so I usually come out with option B. It's somewhere between A and C. And I think it is somewhere between the total hands-off and total imposition of the American model. I think pure tribalism is a thing of the past in Afghanistan. I think it's been so seriously degraded that you cannot look to that any longer for the Afghan solution. I think simply imposing an American model also won't work. And I think the second caller is right. It has to be the Afghans who assent to it and work on it and come together around it, because they're going to have to live with it. But they are going to need encouragement, support, and a sustained support. What we can't afford is to come in, and even if we quote-unquote win in our immediate objectives, then walk away. We cannot wash our hands of Afghanistan again. One of the reasons it's where it is because that's what we did in 1989, mm-hmm. and we can't afford to do that one more time.
Let's get one more quick call here. Frank is on the line. Welcome, Frank. You're on the air.
Hi. I just have one point to make. I'm reading an interesting book right now by Professor Victor Davis Hanson called Carnage and Culture, which reminds anyone who reads it that this conflict with Islam goes back a little further than September 11th.
Yes, we just talked to him last week on this
2001.
Show.
2001. I remember you did interview him, and it's a timely person to be talking to. But the point I want to make is that the American public is a very easy public to lie to because we don't study history. And so when we have people sitting down seriously looking at a TV camera with a straight face telling the American people that Islam is a religion of peace, that the problem is with a few terrorists, a handful of radicals, not only does this fly in the face of the truth of the present, which is that the Saudi regime has put billions of dollars behind the Wahhabist sect, which promotes a very aggressive proselytization of Islam worldwide,
yes.
but
mm-hmm.
it also flies in the face of a history that goes back to Lepanto and before that Poitiers in the 700s and so forth. Where
so, Frank, you're saying we can't negotiate with Islamic people?
Well, I think long-term America is eventually going to realize that all our nation-building utopianism, which applied well to Europe, that shared a certain philosophical basis in the Enlightenment and the Greco-Roman world, will not apply to the Middle East. And
Frank,
eventually,
our time is short, but we thank you for that point.
Yeah.
And let me put it in the time that we have left to Ambassador Thomas Simons. How about it? Frank's saying that Muslims aren't people we can negotiate with.
I just don't believe it. I think Islam is like Christianity or Judaism. It's a 24/7 full-service religion. It has all the questions and all the answers. It has the full range of possibilities. And on a non-Islamic example, I'll just turn back to Jack Beatty with Cambodia. I mean, if you can get something as successful as what has happened in Cambodia in Afghanistan, and I think it's possible to do that, I think we ought to be satisfied.
And to Frank's point that he feels the aggressive edge of Islam, but you see and believe in an edge that's not that way.
I think other edges are possible. You're not fighting for the extremes. The extremes are pacifist and, war forever. I think you're fighting for the middle sector of opinion, country by country and society by society, and that can be won. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a permanent essence to Islam that you can define and that should drive policy. I think you have to work it case by case.
We've got a lot more work to do, clearly. Ambassador Thomas Simons, U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan in 1996 and now at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, there you've got a big boardwalk of elements in play, and we barely had time to get into the situation on the ground where it's clearly not an easy or pretty picture at all.
No, but, I was going back to Mr. Brahimi's, the U.N. ambassador's comment, Wade found to liberate and empower the people of Afghanistan. Perhaps we could deal with some of the second front of the war, the propaganda front, by doing a good job with that. I mean, by really telling the Afghans right now, hey, there's something in this for you. There are seeds. There are wells. There are, grants. We're going to make this country work, and to sort of show the Islamic world, well, we can do other things than drop bombs. We, with the UN, can rebuild this country and sort of get our bona fides back a little bit by showing that that can be done. It isn't quite like Lyndon Johnson, who said he wanted to build a great society on the Mekong. The North Vietnamese didn't want that. We don't have anybody, once the Taliban is gone, who's going to say no great society. But it is, I think, crucial to our whole, politique with the Muslim world to get post-Taliban Afghanistan right. And the Cambodian model is a very encouraging one.
Well, we'd like to believe that can happen, but do you, Jack, believe that the Islamic world will – is it something they want to buy? Is it something they'll want to see, a government or a nation brought into prosperity by non-Islamic support?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it would be it can look colonial, but if you've got 100 countries involved, if you've got the UN involved, if you've got Fijians there and people from Guatemala, it's very hard to depict it as a U.S. thing. I think the UN is very crucial here.
Well, it's all in gear. It's all engaged. We'll see where we end up. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. While the cities of New York and Washington were attacked, the pangs are also being felt in small towns across America. And, says writer Chris Kimball, the values of these towns might hold the answers to helping the nation heal.
Since September 11th, I've thought a lot about disaster. In Vermont, where I grew up and now spend summers and weekends, I'm used to disaster in many forms, an overturned tractor, a barn fire, or a bucking chainsaw. And over time, I've learned to take precautions. I always park my pickup facing home when logging in the woods. I don't change gears on a loaded tractor when going downhill. And I don't stack green hay in a barn, since it can spontaneously burst into flames. I've met locals with one arm, parents who have lost children in hang accidents, and met more than one mill worker down at Miles Lumber who's at least one finger short. One of my most vivid memories as a child was watching Colonel Vaughn's barn burn from the top of Swearing Hill. At first, it looked like a small brush fire, and then I realized that it was a day I would never forget, the smoke curling up into the sky, dark and sinister, as if left by an invading army. But last spring, disaster took a more personal turn. Charlie Bentley, the farmer who hired me during summers back in the 60s to pitch hay and milk cows, was injured in a serious tractor accident. Charlie was working under a disc harrow, and when the tractor started up, the harrow dropped suddenly and caught him by the neck. He was dragged through the field face down until the tractor could be stopped. He survived. Vermont farmers are hardy folk. But as my family's last living connection to a life which is long gone from Vermont's Green Mountains, we were all shaken. Within days, a neighbor organized a pancake breakfast fundraiser. I cooked 35 pounds of homemade sausage. Others made vats of pancake batter. The country store sent along gallons of orange juice, and locals donated items for a silent auction. On a crisp spring morning in June, 250 kids, farmers, carpenters, plumbers, truckers, and dairymen raised over $10,000. Not much by city standards, but an impressive sum for a town that has fewer residents that would fit into the Methodist Church. The rest of the summer never regained its rhythm, so my wife and I decided to hold a covered dish supper over Labor Day weekend. Neighbors brought molasses, lace, baked beans, ambrosia, three-bean salad, macaroni chili casserole, vegetable lasagna, honey cake, and cherry pie, along with their folding lawn chairs. We stacked bales of hay for a table, boiled 150 ears of Silver King and Bodacious corn, and served up 60 pounds of barbecued beef. As night came, we turned on the strings of construction lights hanging from the trees, and the kids scattered into the nearby cornfield playing hide-and-seek. Charlie Bentley showed up and did his part, tucking into seconds, casting an eager eye towards the softer, more brightly colored desserts. Everything finally seemed back to normal on that evening as we sat together in tattered lawn chairs, drawn in a circle under an ancient maple tree, listening to a distant thunderstorm that was slowly moving up the valley. A column of boys paraded smartly around the gathering with sticks held stiffly over narrow shoulders. Lightning flashed in the distance like approaching artillery, and groups of families slowly dissolved into the night, enveloped by pear trees and darkness. In the country, families are not a lifestyle. They are instead the bedrock, the foundation, the place we return to each night to find a hot supper and a warm fire. Families are chicken and biscuit dinners at the fire station, Friday night football, homecoming day, and a hot Sunday afternoon in August, the rescue squad, and the promise of a plate at the table for unexpected guests. It's politics and coffee at the country store, sitting around a boiling evaporator in March, drinking Genesee and telling stories that are sometimes true. Family life is a continuum, a force that absorbs disasters and tragedies. It is always there when you need it, even when you start up the pickup and head out of town, never to return. Just then, the distant thunder was upon us, and I awoke from thoughts of the coming storm by the sound of our children in the cornfield. In our nation's darkest hour, they called out from the heart of America, reminding us that every small town is a great nation, and each child is a nation unto himself.
Chris Kimball is a cookbook author and the publisher of Cook's Illustrated Magazine. He lives in Boston and Vermont. You can listen to and read radio diaries featured on Special Coverage by going to our website, log on to WBUR.org, and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.